Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth.
I truly believe that thoughts are the greatest vehicle to change.
We do not care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it can catch mice.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
Teamwork is the ability to work together toward a common vision. The ability to direct individual accomplishments towards organizational objectives. It is the fuel that allows common people to attain uncommon results. Is a quote from Scottish-American industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie, who was one of the great American success stories, best known for captaining the expansion of the American steel industry in the late 19th century. I thought this was an apt quote for our guest today, a problem solver, someone who is heavily engaged in the steel industry, but from a different angle, as a leader in the mining of metallurgical coal, with a portfolio of mines and development projects in Australia and the United States to fuel what is an insatiable global demand for steel. Our guest today is Douglas Thompson, Chief Executive Officer of Coronado Global Resources Incorporated, a leading producer of high-quality metallurgical coal. Prior to his appointment as CEO in 2023, he was Chief Operating Officer of Australia. He was also previously Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer of Thiess within CIMIC Group. During this time, Douglas was also Mining and Mineral Processing Executive at CIMIC, which included accountability for leading the group's operating company, Sedgman. Douglas commenced his mining career at Goldfields Limited in South Africa. Hello and welcome to another episode of No Limitations, a show where we speak to elite world-class performing men and women and unlock the secrets and influences that have shaped their destinies and that you could apply to your own life. For our first-time listeners from all over the world, please don't forget to follow on your preferred podcast platform and share with your friends and colleagues. And for our listeners in South Africa, China and India, a big hello. I am your host, Greg Robinson, Managing Partner of Blenheim Partners, board and executive search firm. In this episode, we journey with Douglas as he shares his stories behind the operations of one of the world's largest metallurgical coal producers. He provides an expose into the complex world of mining, the current market and geopolitical dynamics, as well as the enormous opportunities ahead as the world looks to wrestle with an imbalance in supply and demand. We examine the state of affairs for the industry on Australian soil, the political hurdles, the funding challenges, and the great opportunity as a nation we are missing. For Douglas, mining is far more than another hole in the ground. It's about the people. It is an industry with a wealth of career opportunities, global prospects, and an incredible network of close-knit communities. Lastly, Douglas shares his philosophies on leadership, communication, and teamwork, but poignantly concludes with some personal reflection that I would encourage all to listen. So sit back and enjoy another hole in the ground. Douglas, welcome to the show.
Greg, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today.
Douglas, in light of the global efforts to transition to renewable energy sources, how do you see the future of coal, particularly in terms of market demand and the long-term sustainability?
Greg, and particularly the commodity we in being met coal, I'm very excited about the future. The world is sitting in a situation that its demand for steel is just going to grow. It's shown most recently in India. If you look at their economics, their GDP grew over just 6% last year, but their steel investment is 12%. And really that Asian market, Indian market, is going to be the driver of steel production into the future, and there's no real substitute for met coal. People are looking at green steel opportunities, but there's nothing in the horizon that we see as a business that is of scale. The technology is there, but bringing it to market on scale and the amount of blast furnaces built that need met coal to produce steel and being built is going to create a supply-demand imbalance in the market for met coal. And then the other side of it is where industry isn't being supported to create new supply, investment is waning. So there's going to be a clear imbalance in supply demand, particularly in met coal. If you cast the net over coal entirely, and our business is a met coal business, but on coal, I think coal still has a clear place in the energy mix and ensuring that we have a stable grid, we have a responsible way of transitioning. The world has chosen to transition. It's our task as industry to support that and move forward. But met coal is key to that solution. The world needs steel, and steel starts here, as per our motto. To produce steel, you need met coal. So we're very, very excited about the future of met coal into the future.
Look, can you treat me as a novice for a second, Douglas? Can you do me a favour and just give me the quick rundown, the differences between the coal groupings? You've got met coal, but you've got thermal coal. Can you give us brown coal, you know, clean coal? Can you give us a bit of a quick rundown?
Greg, you're not alone. I actually sometimes smile at looking at our politicians that talk informally, but they actually haven't invested the time to inform themselves. There are two totally different commodities. The one is burnt to generate an energy source to power turbines and alike. You go all the way back to Rudolf Diesel that invented the diesel engine. He extracted from the mineral fuel sources that he could run his engines on. It was a very reliable fuel source for the world today. And you look at world's economies, they're driven by energy. If you pair it all back and try and find a common denominator through world economies, it's energy. And cheap energy and coal for a very long time has been the highest form of concentrated energy, sun energy and plant energy that man has leveraged to huge advantage to drive our economies. And now we're seeing opportunity for technology to move beyond that. So that's thermal coal, and it's got a number of different nomenclatures like power station coal and alike. The opposite side of it, without digging into the technicalities of it, is met coal. And met coal is used in a number of forms, but quite a bit turned into coking coal, which is a source of energy to produce steel. And there's a chemical process in a blast furnace when you add iron ore to it, and there's a particular ratio you add it to, and that's used to produce steel in the simplest form. The advantage that Australia has in both of those materials is we've got high quality thermal coal and met coal. So you need less of it to produce the steel. So the less emits less. And it is also of a higher quality. It's got fewer impurities than some of the other markets that we compete with in. And that's also good for the world. And that's why we're trying to advocate for Australia and parts of the US to be the supply of coal going forward. As you pointed out, there are other forms like brown coal and the like that you can go into. And that's just describing localized language of different qualities of thermal coal and met coal. That probably is not helpful for the audience today, but that clear distinction between thermal coal and met coal and their end uses is really important to understand.
Yeah, what are we sitting on in terms of resource supply and in tonnage that if we wanted to dig up across the east coast of the country in both thermal and met?
We are hugely endowed as a nation with really high quality energy. I can't understand why we're imposing such high burdens on ourselves for energy within this country with the resources that we do have. If I bring it back to our business, our East Coast business being Coronado, we own a Curra in Queensland. It's two large open cut mines and we in the process of building an underground mine on that same footprint. That's got over a billion tons of reserve. Across our group of companies, we've got 2 billion tons of reserve and we've got 800 million tons of resource. The difference between the two is, I'd say, analysis of understanding the quality of your geology, ensuring you understand the resource well, and how mineable is it. By the time you're getting it to reserve state, you're saying, I can see economic value out of this, and I can extract it out of the ground and find a market for it. We've got 800 million tons of it in our business alone, and we own Logan in the United States, which is four undergrounds and an open cut, and we own Buchanan, which is probably the biggest underground longwall business in the US, and then soon to be three mines in our power complex. Compared to the BHPs and the Anglos, we're not a player of their size. We're a scale player. We're producing about 16 million tonnes per annum, and we're growing the business to 20. So we're the big end of town, but we're nothing like a BHP in Anglo. So Australia is usually endowed with great resources. Unfortunately, we keep on throwing barriers in our way to extract those economically.
All right, well, just maybe give us a quick rundown then. What is Coronado Global Resources?
Coronado Global Resources is a business that started by two founders, Jerry, our founder, and Jim Campbell, his co-founder with in private equity firm called EMG in 2013, saw the opportunity to consolidate great quality met coal assets that weren't getting the best value extracted out of them and consolidating them and building a new business. And that's how the business was formed. They initially bought a mine called Greenbrier. Quickly after that, made a few other acquisitions, including Buchanan and Logan, and then looked over the ditch and could see the great quality in Australia's met coal assets and managed to buy Curragh off Wesfarmers. And that built the base we're standing on at the moment, where we've got a very good quality resource base, 800 million tonnes of reserve, great markets, mature markets that we trade into, access to markets. And off the back of that, I've now got a baseball business that we're leveraging up and we're making more of it. So the last 18 months post-COVID, which really took the wind out of everybody's sails, so we've been taking the business post that period, is we've been invested into our assets to drive productivity, ensuring that we can make the most of what we have today, in particularly out of Buchanan and Curragh. And our next phase in that is growth. And we're looking at investment in Queensland to build a new underground mine at Curragh. And in the United States, we've already built a new southern district. So we've got two long walls at Buchanan now. And we're investing in untapping that by building a new shaft and upgrading our processing and material handling facilities on surface as we grow the business to be more than a 20 million tonne producer into the future. So what are we? We're a no-nonsense, very proud met coal miner in a very buoyant market.
Well, talk us through that. Who's buying the product?
We sell most of our product into Asia. India is obviously the growing market that everybody's talking about. We generate about 24% of our present revenues in India. Japan's still our biggest customer destination to a number of clients there. That's likely bigger than India at the moment. Into Korea, into South America. Quite a bit of our product in the US goes domestic. We sell a little bit of into Europe, and we're selling about 7 to 8% of our product into China. These are relationships that have been established for more than 40 years. You know, Buchanan's been around 40 years, so is Curragh. People have built their blast furnaces and their technology on our products, and we're ensuring that we're enhancing our products and continue to meet their future needs as we work on our emission side of the curve and they work on their emission side of the curve so we can move products to the future.
So the upside for us then, what you're saying, Douglas, is the purity of the product. It's a Class A product compared to who else is putting their thermal coal into the market.
There's a number of players that put thermal coal into the market. It's not our business, so I'll comment from what my knowledge is, but South Africa produces quite a bit of thermal coal. Yep. Russia produces quite a bit of thermal coal, and PCI coal are of lower quality that finds its way, particularly into markets like India and into China at the moment. And Mongolia produces lead coal, if we turn to that, and they've upped their production substantially into China over the last couple of years, now that they've solved some of the logistic challenges that they had finding their way into that market. And then China themselves is a huge producer of thermal coal and met coal. For businesses like us, where you can see India is probably where China was 20 years ago, they've got great thermal coal deposits and they've got great iron ore deposits, but they don't have met coal. So their import demand for met coal into the future is going to be phenomenal. We're looking at double the production now by 2050. Almost 2.3 times what is being seaborne shipped into India will grow. So there's a huge market demand of high-quality met coal into India as they push their steel production into the future. And they don't have a local solution. They've got a local solution for thermal coal. They've got a local solution for iron ore, but not for met coal. And that's obviously the excitement in the market that we see for a business like Coronado.
And Doug, let's just out of interest, if I went, you know, up in Queensland tomorrow and I came across some terrific land and I thought, okay, there's some coal sitting here, how difficult is it for me, just for the layman's terms, to get the license to dig?
Permitting in...
Because you're talking about acquiring assets, i.e. you bought from Wesfarmers, but outside of doing that, if you actually explored it and found it yourself, how hard is it to get the rights to do it?
Incredibly challenging, I would say, at this stage. Some of the regulation of our industry has been appropriate. The industry itself is quite happy with the regulation because we want to be seen as responsible custodians of the resources that we mine and extract.
Sure.
Some of it, unfortunately, becomes politicised and people lose sight of what is really the driver behind the economy and the business versus politicising it. Well, unfortunately, the last couple of years, I'd say the mining industry has been vilified, because people haven't understood it and don't understand the high thresholds self-imposed and by regulation imposed upon the industry to be a responsible citizen. If you look at Queensland at the moment, well, we're very fortunate at Curra. We are fully permitted. So we are allowed to mine all of the resources we have at that operation. But if you had a new discovery as you're talking about now and you wanted to bring it to market, you're probably looking between 5 to 10 years. Realistically, to bring that opportunity to market. And investors aren't that patient. Going through the red tape and the green tape that quite often in the industry's view and my personal view doesn't make it any safer or doesn't make it any more environmentally responsible is wasteful and distracts from opportunities of bringing new product to market quickly. There's other hurdles. For example, where a government acts without proper consultation to the industry and spooks investors, like we've recently experienced in Queensland, where Queensland changed its royalty scheme to not only be the highest in the world, but also without any consultation. A large portion of my job is going around the world and speaking to investors, attracting them to our business and showing them our differentiation from others. That kind of shock to the system makes them take their money and go elsewhere. And when BHP...
Well, that's borderline sovereign risk, isn't it?
Absolutely. When a business like BHP says, look, we're not going to invest in growth in Queensland anymore, we should all be paying attention to what that means for the state and, I think, frankly, the country, because that sovereign risk insecurity and where investors go, it's just too hard and it's too risky, because investing in a mining asset is long-term. A investor has to ride the market cycles with you and they have to see how they're going to make money at the top of the cycle and at the bottom of the cycle to get their returns at the end. To say, well, they're making super profits, that needs to be shared out. We had really good structures. Everybody invested within those tax structures. To change them without notification and rub the top off takes the NPV shine off projects and the money probably finds itself to other markets. Just like in our business, we're investing very strongly in the US at the moment because it makes more economic sense for us.
Yeah, what's the regulations compared to, you know, US compared to Australia? Far easier to work within the US, far more supportive or not?
Absolutely. In the states that we're in, West Virginia and Virginia, yes. Yeah, here's an anecdotal example. We announced effectively a new mine. We were saying we were going to build the Southern District at Buchanan, so we've got a northern longwall. We've now, over the last 18 months, developed and built out the Southern District. The governor of Virginia came underground, did a ribbon cutting with us and helped us celebrate that we were creating jobs and training people within his state and creating future economic growth. We don't see that support from politicians in Australia for our industry. Regulation-wise, we'll set very high thresholds in the US that we have to meet as well. And we're happy to meet those and we're happy to move as society moves and technology moves. But when you set aspirational targets without technology in the middle and policy isn't supporting you to bridge the gap, it becomes very difficult to find that investment incentive to go out on the edge, find the technical solution and make sure that investment in the state makes sense. So the money just simply goes elsewhere.
Yeah, but it'd be interesting too if the Treasurer actually sat down one day and said, okay, let's put a line through coal in Australia. They'd be short a lot of money, wouldn't they, on the exports?
Oh, absolutely. You can see just in the budget that's come out now on how the industry, and particularly coal, underpins this budget and the importance of it going forward and into the future prosperity of everybody. Mining in Queensland touches 1 in 4 jobs. So everybody,
What is it, one in four?
One in four jobs is touched by mining. So in the southeast corner, where people aren't understanding the impact in the region, they need to start appreciating the direct impact that it's going to have to the strength of the economy. And I think this budget demonstrates it. If you don't have that investment into the future, and these assets need constant sustaining capital and they need growth capital, you start turning that off, you can see what future budgets will look like very transparently through the metrics that have come through in this budget at the moment, where investment in or taxation from our industry, how it's supporting this budget and how important it is to the future.
All right, going to be a novice again, Douglas. The actual process of using coal through the furnaces, through the energy grid, et cetera, what comes out of that? You know, obviously pollution is what we hear, et cetera, that's the whole bit of it. Is it cleaner? Is it overrated what we're hearing? Or what is there a bit more myth than mystery here?
Look, anything we do as society has an impact. You've got to weigh up the pros and cons of that impact. We're seeing at the moment in renewables, the difficulty to get some of those projects approved in the timeframes that they're promised because they are having impacts as well. So one has...
They're also struggling with investment as well.
Exactly. Because the return on investment is becoming very difficult unless the government supports it. And that has to be a red flag to any investor if it doesn't have a proper
subsidized
support. So to answer your question, and on thermal coal, there's an area to cover off, but once again, it's not our commodity. But thermal coal is used to produce energy. In the most basic form to describe it, you burn it, you liberate the energy. It's a very high concentrated form of energy, so it's highly efficient. It's used in different forms like turbines and that, and it transfers its energy into electrical energy, into thermal energy that's consumed in the grid, and it has emissions. There is advances in power stations, like now we would heli power stations, where they are supercritical and the emissions are much lower than power stations that were built decades ago. So there's technological advancements that can be done to limit their impact, and even you can do carbon capture to reduce their impact significantly. But that's thermal coal. Let's talk about our business, met coal. So in a blast furnace, as per your example, you're putting a combination of iron ore, met coal, and other minerals, depending on what the quality of the iron ore is, that you take the impurities out of the iron ore as the chemical process reacts. Now, met coal is taken through a process of turned into coke, where essentially it's put in a coking oven, it's heated up, and the fluidity of it or the volatiles come off, and it stays as quite a dense, high concentration of carbon. And it's that carbon in the blast furnace of the iron ore that forms a chemical process without going into the chemistry here, that forms the liquid iron ore that is then processed into plate steel, rolled steel, and so on and so forth. The slag is taken to the side. There is a portion called PCI, which is pulverized injection, and that's injected while you've got your furnace going, so that high carbon concentrate and iron ore as a heat source to produce it. And really, that is the chemical process. Yes, there are emissions that come off it. Because we've got high quality products, the emissions are less. But secondly, there are a number of industry processes or technologies that are proven to reduce those emissions. And I think there would be great value in continuing to encourage the industry to spend money there versus chasing some of the opportunities that are so far down the curve and governments pouring a huge amount of money into green steel. For example, to make green steel, some of it is where you'd use scrap iron and use that to produce steel again. Because it's one of the beauties of steel, it's a constant renewable energy source. You can reprocess it all the time. So they can melt it down and reuse it. And there is a blast furnace or a furnace technology to use that. It's called arc furnace. It doesn't use a carbon source like we would use as in met coal. But you need to have a large portion of supplied scrap steel to do that. Now, countries like Europe, like the United States, per capita, they've got a high proportion of scrap steel because they, quite well advanced on their technological development. But places like India, the scrap steel available per capita is very low. So you can see the world is now regulating that scrap steel is something that they won't ship around the world readily. They'll bank it up and use it. So mature markets can take advantage of that, but they have to re-gear their whole processing and manufacturing of steel to achieve that. Processes like producing green steel with hydrogen is far less mature, particularly on scale. Yes, technologically available, but you need a few things that the truth needs to be told about. For example, you need magnetite, not hematite, in most of those chemical processes that are in lab technology and testing phase at the moment. The world is well endowed with hematite deposits, but not well endowed with magnetite deposits. There's not enough magnetite in the world to substitute hematite or blast furnace technology. So there's very large hurdles the world has to jump over before it can become a true substitute. So where we talk about our industry's platform for markets going to be eroded by green steel and using hydrogen technology, some of the truth needs to be told about the other side of the equation, or where will you get the raw material, because there isn't enough magnetite to substitute the way we make steel, and the insatiable growing demand of steel production going forward as the world seeks to transition the way in which we draw our energy, because that's going to need a lot of steel. A lot of infrastructure has got to be rebuilt to enable our energy transition.
Well, I know we're known as the lucky country. Sometimes we're called the smart country. Here you are producing or digging these big holes across the country, exporting the product around the world to countries which actually make steel. Why can't we do it in our own backyard? Here we are talking about an economy which is struggling, unemployment going up, a lack of energy, inflation, and we need to do something to put this country on the map, and here's an opportunity and a half. Is it too politically sensitive, or why can't it be done?
Greg, there's a number of reasons. If you take it down to the way I see it, my personal views are it's political will and it's finding our place within the world's market as a nation. As you said, we are blessed with great resources. You can clearly pick up my accent is different. I came here for a reason, and the reason was to learn from Australia on productivity and then to learn a different culture and work in a different mining environment, wildlife, place of birth, deep-level gold mining in South Africa. And I clearly fell in love with it. I've been here for 20 years, so I'm not going to complain too much because the nation is blessed. But we are missing a few tricks. We've got really cheap energy. We should be using that strategic market advantage to reposition ourselves in the world. And yes, we will have advantages with great sunshine and wind within the country with the renewables over time. But to date, we've had really, really cheap gas and we've got cheap thermal that we could use as an advantage, because energy is one of your biggest advantages. And then the other is a highly skilled, highly productive workforce. And I think in those two areas, we've let ourselves down. We've tried to be a little bit too much of a me too in economy or something. You know, we're going to try and step up to maybe levels where we aren't economically ready to lead the world in some of the environmental thresholds that we set on ourselves. And that's placed a burden on making our energy more expensive. And it's found itself offshore instead of using it locally. So policy and enablement, I think, politically has been short-falling. And companies go to where they make money. We're going to go to the market where our shareholders can get returns. So we've pursued those opportunities. The other side of it is a workforce that is well-educated and productive. From when I came here 20 years ago, it was one of the things that I looked across the water and went, how do the Aussies do it so well that their production per person in a mine is so high? Their mechanization, their use of technology is excellent. I came across and I saw 4 or 5 years of great learning that I could see us going forward. Unfortunately, I've seen erosion over the years in STEM subjects that we teach people at school, the enablement and encouragement by our government to send people into universities to pick up trade skills and STEM subject type skills to drive an economy like ours forward. Just policy's been lacking in that place. I think we've enabled universities to become places of profit instead of driving nation education. And then I've also just seen layer upon layer of bureaucratic process of leveraging a productive workforce. And if we could shake ourselves loose of, I think, those two things, cheap energy and driving good policy in that place, and enablement of development of second order production and manufacturing onshore, and a workforce that is productive compared to the rest of the world, we should have no reason of standing back to anybody else. But at this stage, we've hooked our wagon to other economies and we're selling them our products, and then they turning them into high value and selling them back to us. I think we're missing a great opportunity.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree more. And look, from the organisations, the BHPs, et cetera, that you talked about, to change this, there needs to be vision from either side of the fence in government. As a CEO of a mining company, are you being engaged by governments properly?
Properly, and
it's a tough call, but properly, right? No, thinking long term as opposed to the next election.
Greg, I'd say sadly no. We do get opportunities to spend time with state government and federal government, but I think the conversations that we're having aren't the proper conversations of, let's stop vilifying the industry. Let's start full and respecting the place of the industry within the nation building to date, and the potential of nation building into the future, and enabling it. Yes, holding the industry accountable, making sure that taxpayers get their share of return, ensuring that we are responsible custodians of the resources, but enabling the industry as primary to the country and looking long-term, particular looking beyond electoral cycles and supporting us into the future. We also are accountable. We spent a lot of time saying, you know, we're important to the economy. This is our value proposition. Our value proposition has to go long beyond our contribution to the economy. How we help people come to work and be proud of what they do, how they add value every single day, that they can stand up and felt accounted for in any conversation that they're in, that I'm part of an industry that does what they do well and they're proud of what they do. I think we step too far back from that and just quietly try and get on with what we're doing without creating too much noise. And I think we've got a very valuable voice and we need to speak louder as an industry.
Yeah, I was wondering, are the CEOs coming together well enough and is the voice being represented strong enough? And that, but there's another part to it, Douglas, also, which is funding. Are the banks tightening up?
Absolutely. Particularly here in Australia, you wouldn't find funding and you wouldn't actually go and source funding from a traditional bank at this stage. We moved a while ago, and I think all our peers have done the same. We've gone to capital markets. It's not that they have a different lens over ESG at all. They are actually governed by the same requirements and actually just as high. But they've applied their minds to understanding, for example, the difference between met coal and thermal coal. So our thermal coal producers are having difficulty raising investment. Met coal is a larger market and there's more opportunity for us because people understand the value and that we part of the solution into the future with the energy transition, but mostly they can see the fundamentally fantastic market opening up and the supply-demand imbalance, and they're saying that's going to give us great returns into the future, and we'll make sure that the people that we invest in meet our thresholds so that they in turn are responsible investors. So Asian markets and the US markets are very favourable for our style of business, and we're finding good investment.
How do you find being a leader in the sector?
I love it. I chose the career instead of farming. I come out of a family of frustrated farmers that went mining. We actually hired, my dad and I hired rehabilitated land back from a mine that my dad was working on because, thank you, it was cheap and the carrying capacity of the rehabilitated land was a bit better than our neighbours. And we part-time farmed in it. And I thought that would be my career. And I love problem solving. So I picked mechanical engineering as my first form of study, thinking, well, I could use that on the farm. And my dad arranged me a job at the mines, in the gold mines up in the Transvaal. And I went and worked there to advance my knowledge, but also co-fund my studies. And I just fell in love with it. The scale of the operations, what I could play with as a young engineer, was intoxicating. And I quickly decided I wanted to change careers. And then I think the other thing was working with people on the farm, realizing that building team, understanding people's skills, good communication, the trust in the team, and replicating that in the mining industry showed me that people was where I was more inclined. So I did more studies in engineering after that because that's a passion, but quickly found my way into people. And I found mining and the mining industry has provided me a career second to none. I joke when I talk to people and I say, I dig holes for a living, but I've probably seen more countries around the world, more cultures around the world, because this career has enabled me to go work with fantastic people all over the world, helping them solve their problems in mineral extraction.
Look, it's a pretty incredible role when you think about it, isn't it? Now, a chief exec of a bank goes to the office, comes home, 9 times out of 10, they've got to worry about derivatives, that invisible number up there, share market, etc. But you've got to go home, look at the same thing, the numbers, same stakeholders, and different stakeholders, but being engaged by them locally and internationally. You've got to deal with permits, you've got to deal with government, okay, both parties deal with that. But you also got to deal with health and safety. And the aim is to make sure everyone who goes comes home that night. And I'm sure you've seen stuff in South Africa and throughout all your travels around the world where some people haven't made it home. That's a different factor than most people have in a job.
I'd say the darkest day in anybody's career is when you lose a team member under any circumstances. It's gut-wrenching for everybody, but particularly the families. In the midst of that trauma and hurt and search for how could we do this differently that we're always striving for is how do we improve this? How do we reduce the risk? How do we educate people better to understand the environment they're in and risk tolerance? And not just in things that can kill people, but their health and well-being, their mental well-being as well. We all stretch ourselves and pursue this relentlessly. And I must admit, it probably occupies a large portion of my thinking when I think about this business and the losses I've been in before. But in the midst of that tragedy, I've seen some of the greatest examples of human beings, where people come alongside families and walk a very difficult path going forward because they would be changed. Either a family member's hurt and they changed, or tragically they've lost a family member. And watching how people rise to the occasion and be better human beings as you'd ever expect, making a path with a person and being willing to be there all the way through, to where leaders turn around and take a team from tragedy and lift the standards and use the tragedy as an opportunity to set a new benchmark in the industry for cultural expectations or finding a new technology to ensure that never on our watch again type opportunities. That is awe-inspiring. So as much as it is heavy on one's shoulders when you think about the responsibility of people's lives and their well-being every day, the opportunity of if you harness that culture well of creating something exceptional is probably what I lean into more. That excites me.
You're listening to No Limitations with special guest Douglas Thompson. In our next episode, I sit down with Robert Spurway, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer of GrainCorp Limited.
I think you learn as much from people around what not to do as what to do, and being really mindful of that and being self-aware. I think leadership starts with self-leadership, learning about yourself, having that discipline, leading by example, and that's a model we apply in GrainCorp.
Be sure to join us on our next episode. And now, back to the show. You're a little bit different. So you came from South Africa, and as you said, you had an ambition to see how great mining is being done, so you wanted to come to Australia. But you've been on the contracting side for a bit of time as well. Why is that?
That's what attracted me. The short anecdote is I was a deep-level gold miner for 13, 14 years. I absolutely loved it. I was blessed by the company I worked for, Goldfields. They sent me to study. And I was running a great gold mine called Oryx with a team that needed to be rebuilt. And while I was rebuilding that team, I used some external experts. And one of them over a cup of coffee said to me, Douglas, go to Johannesburg and meet this contracting company called Thiess. And he said, don't think contractors in the context of South Africa gold mining. These people do things differently. They're really an engineering business. And being an engineer, that caught my interest. So I did the 300-kilometer drive, went to Joburg, had a cup of coffee. And short version is, went home, had a chat with my wife. Joanne played back to me in the kitchen. She said, our kids are young. We're pretty young. Sign a 2-year contract and let's go on an adventure and let's see what comes out of it. That bravery in the moment turned to us moving 3 months later to Australia, signing the contract to Tees, and I became a project manager at Collinsville on an open-cut coal mine with a very strong union background and immersed in this whole new culture, and I absolutely loved it. I came with two drivers. One was to learn productivity. The other was to learn commercial acronym from a contractor, because that I saw different to mine owners. Contractors have to create value every day for themselves, and in the eye of the beholder, they're the principle of the contract, create value. Yep. And I loved that. It was like driving a sports car. It was exciting. Every day you got out of bed and there was a new challenge and a new value proposition you had to create. So I loved and thrived in that environment. And I was a teacher for 16 years. I went from being a project manager on a two-year contract, destined to go back to Africa, to getting support to become a citizen of our family, decided to make this home and educate our kids here. And I grew a career that they moved me around Australia and ultimately around the world, and then finally offered me the CEO role. And I was absolutely blessed to have it. You know, if you would think you'd come through that career path through business in that period of time. And for 4.5 years, I helped set the strategy for the business into the future. In that time, 50% of the business was sold to leverage the balance sheet so that the business could grow again. And I started looking at the next exciting horizon. And that kind of got to the point where I said, look, if I'm going to stick around now, I'm probably in for another 4 years. And I decided it was time. I needed to step out and let somebody else come in with fresh ideas to drive the strategy forward for Teach. And then Jerry Spindler, the founder of Coronado, gave me a call and said, I'd like to go to lunch with you. And as I say, the rest of the story is history. I very, very honored to have been offered the CEO role of this business and like its next chapter and its strategy for the future.
My old man was ex-Teach. So I grew up every 6-12 months. We had moved site to site, camp to camp. So I know where you came from. It's not easy, but boy, do you see some stuff that no one else is going to see. One of the things I was going to ask, Douglas, because you are privileged in the sense that you got to work internationally with Teese, so therefore you're engaged by some of the very best organisations in the world and what they're doing. Any standouts in the way of leadership you saw or thinking from all your experience or creativity in doing this, in doing the role?
So many. What I eventually saw part of my role, because you cannot say to a client, I'm yet to talk to you about your business if you haven't actually put fingerprints or blueprints on their asset. So I traveled constantly while I was in Teese. I wanted to make sure that at least once a quarter, or maximum 6 months, depending on the scale of the project, I had my blueprints on the ground with my team and the client's team collectively looking at the challenge. And every time I just got great information. So I became this gatherer of ideas and pushed it back through a team that we had that would reprocess those ideas and then spread them out through the business as quickly as what Teese could to keep an edge on the market. You learn something great from a client, suck it into the business purpose that will then push it out to your other clients. So I have many, many stories and anecdotes of fantastic technology advancements in that. For me, every time I went past the tech, it was the human beings, the endeavor. And where I saw it work the best is where purpose and place was clearly defined. People knew why they were coming to work. They knew what the goal was or they knew what the challenge was. There was clear definition of role and accountability and great communication within the team to share knowledge, and that needed trust. And that's where I saw the leadership is. When I went to these and I saw leaders who could create trust in the team, everybody knew their purpose and place. They knew how they contributed to the common goal, and they were willing to be vulnerable and say, I've tripped over my bootlaces, I need the team to pick me up. Those are the tools that stood out. Regardless of the technology, regardless of the problem, those are the teams that I saw could always offer the most of the learning back. But it was that common denominator of purpose and goal, the right players in the right roles, being clear about their accountability, being vulnerable in their accountability within the team, and then a leader that created trust within the team to share information really quickly is where I saw the biggest denot, and that transcended every culture I went to.
Yeah, and typically TIS doesn't work in the cities too often, particularly if you're in mining, so you're in the back of nowhere in different parts of the world. What about the actual locals that you got to meet, or the communities that you think you've helped change? What's been some of the, I guess, memorable moments for you, or outcomes for those people?
People want purpose and place, and they want to feel proud in what they've done every day and know that they've got some security into the next day, regardless of culture or language that we speak. The commonalities are higher than what we're different. I think what draws people around a hole, and I always say a mine is just a hole in the ground, it's the people around that hole that make it special. What draws people to that is generally people who like complex problem solving, who are fairly passionate about what they do, and they've got a high resilience and tenacity level to show up when, because mining is not easy, it's complex. Got a lot of requirements, as you described earlier, that are placed on people when they work in the environment. Some standouts in the community, well, I just look at what gets contributed here in Australia. So an anecdote from our 40-year celebration at Curra last year. I won't use names because I don't have her permission, but she'll know exactly who I'm talking about. I refer to a lady that looks after our site team's leadership, senior leadership team, to report directly to the VP, but looks after that whole team. She came to me and she said, while we're celebrating 40 years, my pops walked the first drag line on Curra almost 40 years ago. My father worked at Curra. My husband works at Curra. I work at Curra. Meet my little boy. Do your job properly so that he can work at Curra. That, for me, tells the story of when you dig a hole in the ground and it's got policy that supports it for the long term, you know, 30 years plus, you can tell those stories of people have raised their kids and set their families up for success off the back of this industry. That is the beauty of it. There's many other stories where, for example, in Indonesia, TIS had been in Indonesia for just over 30 years when I was there and did a lot of training and development and lifted people's skills, that we were training people to be trades qualified to be Australian standard. And one of my last tours that I went through was one of my most proud moments, where TIS was rebuilding engines for trucks that would go around the world out of a workshop in Indonesia. And the mechanic that was doing the strip down was a lady. Totally against culture, totally against the education system, and this business had created that environment for people. And that's what mining does. And that's the enablement that we could do and should be doing in states like Queensland for the future.
Okay. Now, as a leader, you're surrounded by mechanical engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers. They're not short of confidence in their own ability 9 times out of 10. How do you lead these type of people?
I think leadership is situational. You have to go into the business or the environment or the crisis or the moment and, as a leader, be able to step back and calmly discern what's going on, read the room, read the environment, and apply what's needed for the situation. So I think that's one of the first things, is situational leadership. For me, that served me my whole career, is service leadership. I see my role is, firstly, understanding the context. Secondly, understanding the goal. So what are we collectively meant to be doing? What is the strategy for the business? What is the purpose of the business? And being able to describe that in the simplest form for myself and then the people around. And then turning around to the resources, being the people, the money, and the time, and enabling that to the best possible way I can to get the desired outcome. And that has served me the best in my career, is that service leadership of understanding purpose and goal, and then enabling those resources that I have, particularly people. As you described, bright, very capable human beings who are there to add value, ensuring that they're in the right role, we've got the right skills, and that they're the right player. And sometimes that means you've got to put grease around your heart as a leader and be very honest with people about their contribution. Because if we aren't and we don't give people clear and concise feedback, they sometimes are the misplay in the team to deliver the goal. But nobody's actually been really honest with them about that. And I think that's one of the biggest favors you can do to people is respectful, clear feedback so that they know how to play within the team effectively. And then again, you can enhance that team trust. I learned that actually in a dusty paddock on a farm in South Africa, where my dad used to set me off with a team, which, you know, because we were farming Saturdays and Sundays, so you worked as hard as you could in those days. I'd go off as a really young guy with a team into a paddock and, for example, rustling bulls because we needed to mute them, cut their horns. And you needed to know what each other's skills are. You needed to know who's at the gate, who's going to let the bull in, where the bull's going to position itself, who's going to be doing which task. Otherwise, people get hurt. And being able to trust the other person to do their job and do their job well, and if they were having a problem, to communicate that with you, meant trust. So dirty, dusty, working in South Africa in those paddocks taught me some of those basic skills in trying to lead teams like that that has served me through my career to today. And then the last bit is, as a leader, get out of the way. Once you've identified the goal, you've set the context, you've got your team set up, you've built those dynamics, let the team run. They generally will surprise you with what they can do if you just get out of their way.
Quick one, coming out of South Africa, and for all, look, one of the things as a search firm, you do global searches and all the Australians, the expats who come back to the country, all feel very devalued. All the skills I've learned overseas never seems valued. I've got to go two steps back. If I come from South Africa and I'm not from Australia, did you have to start two steps down to build again?
In part, I was fortunate because I was very well educated through my career, through Goldfields and additional studies that I did. And I had statutory tickets that Australia needed at that stage. I was a first-class mine manager, so things like SSCs that evolved over time, those roles were needed so I could slot into them. I would say there is a wasted process in getting those people to be efficient. Just look at electricians. They come in, they've been a person of competency for years, and then we say, okay, well, let's make sure you can work within our legal framework and our standards. But then you've got to go back 2 years. I think it's 2 years electrician has to go back to work as an understudy in the field to prove their competency instead of having tapes and processes where we can test people's competencies and get them to be far more productive quicker. But in our industry, we're working so hard to make ourselves attractive to people to join our industry. And there's been a drive to get a gender diversity. You bring a really bright, really capable female into the industry and they've educated themselves, they've worked themselves up into the industry or in their career at least. You bring them into the industry and you put them at a mine site and you say, look, I think you can run. And they go, I know I can run this. But unfortunately, before we can give you a stat ticket to run this, we're going to set you back 2 or 3 years in your career. And you've got to go back and do really basic leadership tasks under very junior people to build up your competency before you can sit your statutory exams. And what do these people say? No, I'll go elsewhere. I'll go work in another industry instead of yours. So some of the stuff was done to make sure that people are competent to do the job we're giving. We've poked our finger in our eye, and I think we should sit down and reevaluate that so that we can leverage this resource, skills, or the human beings to the best possible way we can, because time is too valuable to them as well. They're other resources. You set a person like that back 2 years in their career, they're not going to do it. They're going to move on.
Now, when you made the move across to Coronado, you didn't go in as CEO. All right. Then you got promoted a couple of years later to become CEO. That's hard because you're going to have to make some calls pretty swiftly, I assume. So do you, as for people listening out there, for those who did get promoted within the same organisation, very different to coming in from the outside. So you've got a lot of relationships. You've now got to suddenly think through again. How do you go about it?
It is hard. And when you worked in a business like I have, I worked for Goldfields for 13 years, you form friendships that are there with you for life, for teeth for 16 years. I hope with Coronado, if the board sees it that way, for the same length of time. You watch people raise their families. Those must always be really important to you. But I think if you can create a work environment, which I described earlier, where people know their role and place, they know you, that you are a person that will respectfully give them feedback on performance, frequently that regardless of the role you play, that your core behaviors and your core beliefs carry through the different roles you have, they'll give you the grace to make some hard calls and sometimes tell people, frankly, you don't fit in this business. And 9 times out of 10, if you do that really well with that person, they find a place that they do fit and they'll give you feedback later because of your relationship that you built, that that was the best thing that happened for them. But yes, people often describe being a CEO as a lonely place. It can be. You can isolate yourself from the business to protect yourself. I'd encourage all CEOs not to. Get out, get into the business, know your people, let them know you. Let them know that you're vulnerable as well, that you will also make mistakes, that you're willing to be called out. But at the end of the day, you have to make a decision. And once you've made a decision, hopefully earned enough of their trust and workplace that they will follow those decisions because with all the context you've had, that's the best decision you could make for the business. But one can say a lot in a few sentences. It is hard doing that growing up in a business, but you have to be true to yourself while doing it. And you also have to respect the shareholders that have put you in that role to honor your commitments back to them. And that should be your key gaze. What's my purpose? What's the purpose of this business? And am I leading the business in that direction for all the people in the business and the shareholders?
Okay. You've been CEO a couple of times, but you got this role. You took it on board, got promoted. What's the vision for the group?
In the simplest form, our vision is we've got a fantastic platform that this business is built on. It's got 800 million tonnes of reserve in the United States and Australia. So a diversified market, we've got diversified mining methods, we've got great products that are mature in the market, where the market wants more of those. And we're sitting within a market with a supply-demand imbalance. Less investment means less suppliers going to come on, but steel manufacturing is going through the roof. So we need more met coal to support that growth, underpinned by the changes that are coming in the way in which the world's going to source its energy. So we've even got an acceleration that's been driven by the infrastructure projects that governments around the world are driving to enable the transition. So you've got a business on a great platform, strategic platform. So our strategy at the moment, the 5-year investment that we're looking at the moment, is firstly to enhance what we have, make it more productive, invest in it to get the most out of it, set the best teams up for the best success in it, then grow it, which we're in the phase of at the moment. We're growing Buchanan, we're growing Curra, essentially 2 new mines in our stable, a new longwall mine at Buchanan and a new bord and pillar underground in Curra in Australia. And we will be set up on that resource base to take advantage over the next 20 years to exploit for our shareholders and investors. The purpose of this business is that's making great returns for them on our capital investment. And we're doing that as a one commodity business without going out and borrowing more money or having to raise more equity. We're doing it off the cash we're generating out of our business. So we've got a very strong balance sheet that can ride the next 20 years of market off the back of it. And that's our strategy, making the most out of the 8 million tonnes of reserve, making the most out of the market in front of us, and investing in that to take the best advantage. The horizon over that, that I've described to the team, is in the 800 million tonnes of resource, we've got Russell County, an undeveloped mine. We've probably got another underground mine at Curra. We've got X-Pit that we've done the engineering, which is another open cut at Curra. And then we have Mon Valley in the United States as well. That are all opportunities within our business that we presently own that are well advanced in permitting and approvals. And we can bring it online at multiples much lower than anything that's for sale out there at the moment. So we're really, really excited about the strategy for this business. And it's quite clean and simple. It's not convoluted and it doesn't carry much threats within the market.
So we're not looking at acquiring any assets at the moment?
At the moment, no. We focused on it. We've had a history of acquiring assets. We've got a dance card that is full at the moment with just making the most of what we've got. And every time I look at it, the simple math shows the NPV on these returns to shareholders and any other metric you put it through, it's at multiples much lower than what we can buy anything. And particularly now in Queensland, unfortunately, the shine has been taken off acquisitions in Queensland for us versus our organic growth because of a higher royalties and what you'll be bringing in with that debt into your business.
Leadership, you talked about earlier. How do you lead, keep everybody focused, feeling productive when you're trading a commodity? You can't control the price.
That's very true, but there's many levers within the team's control. The most important one that I try and ensure we keep our gaze on is having a plan. Everything that we do should be engineering-led and should have a plan that all of us are subservient to and try to either achieve or surpass. And the next order lever in that is productivity. Where do we spend our best money to get the best productivity out of that to drive that plan and drive it further? Those are the things we can control. Things like price we can't, so making sure we're low enough down on the cost curve or we're working hard to drive ourselves down that cost curve so that we stay resilient. Then there's things like business resilience. Disciplined financial controls in a one commodity business like ours is critical. So ensuring we prudently manage our balance sheet so we've got resilience and we've got liquidity is really important when you can't control the commodity price.
Technology. What are we going to be expecting in the next year? We're hearing AI, but surely using all the visualization, the training, et cetera. What's happening over the hill?
A lot of the technology that the world benefits from now was birthed out of mining over years. Just different forms of engine technology, ventilation systems, and alike. So the industry will continue to have a strong hand in advancing society with our technological advancements. I think a lot of people's focus and energy at the moment is turned on emissions abatement, ensuring that we spend money in a responsible way to reduce our emissions. So you're seeing new battery technology and trucks come out. You're seeing alternate fuels going in so that they're less emitting. For us, talking about our business in met coal, obviously methane is one of our biggest emitters, and ensuring that if we can capture it and use it for beneficial use before it is liberated to the atmosphere, you get huge environmental advantages. So we focused on that. We've got an aspirational target to take our business to a 30% reduction in our emissions by 2050. That's really hard because having open cut mines, there's no real technology or even policy to help us capture that methane before it's liberated to the free phase. So in Australia, we've been running a trial for 18 months to drill ahead of our mining faces, try and tap that gas before we mine it and use it for beneficial use. So, for example, we're running a truck around at Curra at the moment of gas that we're proposing to capture from our mines before it liberates the atmosphere and substitute diesel. In the United States, we've invested in two VAM units, and VAM is essentially where you catalyze methane and you turn it into carbon dioxide, and it's about a 22 times less harmful gas, the CO2 versus methane. And we capture the gas as it paddles out from the underground because it's a lot easier to capture it. We built one, it was so successful in reducing emissions, we built a second. And the exciting thing for us is we've said we want to get to a 30% reduction by 2050. If we deploy our VAM, which is proven technology, and we've got a capital profile to it, we'll achieve that goal alone through that. So we've taken huge strides, and the industry's taking huge strides to advance technology. But technology finds its way into everything we're doing at the moment. Technology like AI is helping operate our drag lines. We're using it across our mine plans. We're using it in our prep plants. We've actually run all the model at the moment where AI is mimicking an operator and trying to see if we can perform better through AI than the operator. I'd say the operator is still winning out at this stage, but we're using different technologies like that.
Are we going to see electric plant equipment in the future?
Look, electric plant has been out there for a long time. For example, our drag lines that are more than 40 years old, they are all electrical. Trolley assist has been in mining for a long time, but if you think of a train and it's got the overhead gantry on electric, trucks have been running through mines where it's deployable to the geological resource for decades. So there's a lot of adjacent technologies that we can bring to bear. I think battery tech is near, and that'll probably be exciting when we go fully autonomous and you can leverage battery technology and large haul trucks with autonomy, and probably put the two together, because then you can take human beings out of ways harm, and you can probably change the way in which you design the holes that you're digging, because people aren't at risk, and that'll probably change the economics of mines again, and use those batteries differently, even with the atmosphere that people are breathing, if you can take the people out of it, and it's fully autonomous and it's battery driven, it's not naturally aspirated, you're probably looking at a technology change in the mines again.
How long are we talking, and when will ever autonomous?
Well, autonomy is, yeah. In the Pilbara, if you drive there now, and you probably drove there for the last 10 years, you drive around a mine and most of it will be autonomous. The train sets that run the iron ore from the mines to the coast are autonomous. There's an autonomous coal mine in Queensland that is in trial phase. There's actually one in New South Wales and one in Queensland, trying to get the technology up the curve to suit the geology of coal versus iron ore. So it's all on the cusp. It's around productivity again and ensuring you get the best out of that investment long term. So it's actually here today. It's about the economic benefit. And when it's made unattractive to invest in, then people turn around and say, look, I'd rather spend my money somewhere else or in the United States than re-equip and reinvest for the next 20 years by making my mine in Queensland autonomous, because I'm not sure if I'll get that return on investment if you've got instability, for example, the royalties that change without consultation. So that investment confidence has to be there again to make that technology more widespread.
Douglas, what does the political leadership in this country need to do to give you guys clarity of what the next 20 years could look like so you actually are going to invest? So in listening to you subtly, if you had the opportunity to invest, you spend offshore rather than here.
I think it's a little bit beyond just the politicians. I think it's all of us as society. We have a vote, and I think we need to value our vote very preciously. And that means we have to educate ourselves and make informed decisions, not just sugar shot, let's give you relief in the short term, but not explain the long-term consequences of that. For example, the debt that we're going into. As voters, we should cherish our vote, educate ourselves, and make sure we're making decisions that are right for us now in the electoral cycle and in the long term. And then it's up to the politicians to step and be upfront about what their policies are and how they play out long term. We've chosen the electoral cycle that we have. It is short-term focused. For a party to hold power, they are going to drive the levers that make sense for them within their policies. I think it's largely up to us as voters to make decisions that we know are right for us today and long-term. But my call out is the bureaucrats in the background, these are hardworking people that are very smart, who set the thread that sit in place for 10 to 20 years, ensuring that is well thought through and well written and is highly consultative with industry to ensure that they've got the best opportunity to write the best policies for the nation to move forward on. There, I think we have a role to play as industries to engage better, play the long game with the bureaucrats as well, make sure that we've got doors are open constantly. And every CEO I speak to, they'd love to have those conversations to give input to policy writing when they get the opportunity. But when a paper comes out and you give them 2 weeks to comment, it just isn't enough time for us to engage properly. And in some cases, we've had no consultation. So I think better consultation and maturity across the board will probably carry us all forward.
Okay. Now, in line with world events, conflicts in Middle East, conflicts in Eastern Europe, challenges across Europe, just even over the EU, just over the last couple of days, going to votes, etc. What does this provide you in terms of opportunity in coal?
I think the reality that we need to get our heads around as leaders of businesses, never mind mining businesses or coal business, is instability is here to stay. Pre-COVID, we all reference COVID, but instability is here to stay, and being able to make sure that you've got a business and a team that can navigate that, a business that's got resilience for markets to move in ways you didn't expect. Look what the Ukraine war did. It was crazy. We're thermal coal. were selling for more than met coal. It was something none of us had seen. We thought it would correct itself very quickly. It did correct. It's corrected now. We're a bit more normal. But it was there for longer. And one of the things we did is we pivoted our business. We took advantage of that. We had some coal that wasn't committed to contract. We could reprocess that product to not be a PCI product, a met coal product. We could reprocess it and make it that it could burn in boilers and be used as a thermal coal. And we sold that into the market and took advantage of it. So I think it's being open to and resilient and lifting your head and watching the horizon is where the opportunities will come through, because governments will play with the market. But at the end of the day, the market will always balance itself. And looking at the wider market, understanding your market dynamics and ensuring you position your business to take advantage of those market dynamics in the short term, taking advantage, but long term, ensuring your business is resilient to them is, I think, where we need to apply our minds and play through the instability that is here to stay.
In terms of markets, I don't know the answer to this, but if I look at education, I look at other exports industries that we have in Australia, often government organisations in different parts of the world to come together to support a focused marketing outcome. Does that exist in coal? Or is it down to you guys to do your own individual?
Predominantly, it's up to us to do our individual. There are places like in the European Union, actually met coal is deemed a critical mineral. They've seen it as a scarce mineral, an enabler for the future, and they've said, hey, we're going to put policy around this. It would be a huge enabler for Australia if we said that met coal was and saw it in the same light as a critical material for the future. Such an opportunity for us as a nation, I think, to follow what the European Union has done with met coal. Those environments do create policy and place. And we have had great examples in the United States and in Australia where we work very well with government for policy and education to enable the industry into the future. And I see no reason why we can't do that into the future. It needs the politics to come out of it and the pragmatic business drivers for government. Because let's be honest, government is a business. We elect these people to run the business of the country. Let's run it like a business and set ourselves up collectively for all of our success.
Okay. Where do you spend your time as a CEO?
Most of my time is spent with people. I get most of my energy from people, so I get drawn to that. So I spend my time going around our business. I'll be honest, I feel my most comfortable in a high-vis shirt at a mine site, looking at a complex problem and talking to a team about how we solve it. They're my kind of people. I relate to them. They relate to me. Obviously, my role as a CEO draws me to investors and shareholders and spending time on the road, engaging with them, ensuring they understand our business offering, how our offering can add value to them, and ideally attracting them to invest into us into the long term. But I would say most of my time in all of those facets of the role is around humans and understanding human need and how I can drive the business forward through that.
What do you need to change? You're going to look at yourself, your performance, the business performance, top of mind. Anything you think you need to look at again?
What we're driving at the moment within the business is telling our story very crisply, making sure people understand what we are. People saw us as a growing consolidator, an M&A business very driven by M&A. We've built a fantastic platform. Now we're in a phase of enhancing and leveraging that platform at multiples lower than others. So ensuring our messaging is crisp to the market and crisp to our people so that we can set the strategy up for the future. For me personally, slowing down, enjoying the ride. All my career been very goal orientated. I set plans in place. I drive for plans. I think about them. Personally, I'm starting to realize that it's actually in the moment, that nanosecond of when it just goes right, or man, we've worked so hard and it hasn't gone right and we're dusting ourselves off and we're standing up again to go again. Those are the things you remember, not the goal, not the outcome. It's actually the moments. And personally enjoying that, enjoying the ride, is what I want to turn my attention to.
How do you go about selecting your team? And what do you look for?
Clearly looking for people that are engaged and passionate about complex problem solving. people that understand that we produce a product that somebody needs to buy at the right price at the end of the day. So ensuring that they understand what style of business we are, particularly because we are largely engineering-led. You would take it for granted that anybody that is coming through our process, we screen them appropriately and they've got the right technical skills. Once you get past that, what excites me the most when I speak to candidates is seeing the potential within the candidate for what aptitude they have, what's their personality like, will their personality fit our style of business, can we bring them into our team and use their skills, but also all of their other bits and pieces of being like them a person and leverage the best out of it. And that's the bit that I usually, when I'm interviewing a person, would look for is, who are you? Can I see you fully? Language that I try and use for myself when I'm teaching the businesses, an African expression, it's actually a greeting, and it's Salbora. And Salbora means I see you. And seeing your people and them truly seeing you, vulnerability has to be there. Because then you see the whole person. If we could see the whole person and create them a workplace that feels safe enough to be seen, you probably get the best out of that person. So I quite often look to see, is that person comfortable enough in themselves? Have they got to a station where they can be who they need to be highly successful in our team with the skill sets that they bring to the table? So I look for those skills.
And yourself, how do you keep yourself agile, sharp, in tune, ahead of the pack?
I spend a lot of time trying to associate with the right people in the form of I look for people that stimulate me in different areas. So there's many mining executives who are far smarter than I am, but I'll watch the way in which they run their businesses or engage with them and learn from them. I have people, for example, where I serve on a church's board, and a church thinks in time periods far longer than our industry does. Spending time with those people, understanding how they think through cycles and how they see people and how they add value, all the way through to my own kids, how they see the world through new eyes, differently, full of opportunity, and try and learn and leverage off them. So a lot of my time watching and observing and learning from other people. I do read a fair amount, making sure that I can pick up a new correspondence and what's out there and what I can leverage off of, particularly if there's something new that's around human beings that is exciting, is generally where my reading will go to. And then the other is finding quiet time. None of us do it enough. I don't do it enough. I use my hobby to do a bit of that. Is sitting and letting things percolate through my head, making myself tested against what I think is the three most valuable resources. The people in the business, the time that I have, which I think is always the one that wins out, and the financial resources, and how in that all of these problems and opportunities and new thinking might find its place to leverage to create more.
And Douglas, the big decisions you've got to make, they are significant. Do you seek counsel? Do you actually sleep on it overnight? Does a naysayer get through? How do you manage all that? Because you're getting it everywhere.
You spoke about earlier what I look for when I interview candidates. One of the things I try and discern when I try and see the person is, are you going to tell me what you truly think, or are you going to try and tell me what I want to hear? I love people that challenge me. I go around and I say it as often as possible to try and get the message across. Please don't ever let me be the emperor with no clothes on. Tell me what you think and I'll take it on board. I'll carry the luggage that is appropriate. Ideally, they do it respectfully, but I'd much rather hear what somebody says about something than them keep quiet and not give me the benefit of their thinking or spread their version of what they think it is around the business, and then you're spending time trying to uncoil that and get the true intent out. So I do seek counsel, but all my life I've relied upon, in the moment, quite often situational leadership, you have to make a decision. You get the best information, you make sure you test it with the best people you can at that time, and then you've got to back yourself. And if you make a wrong call, be honest with yourself and those around you. Say, I made a wrong call, I'm dusting myself off, I'm getting back up, are we going again? For that vulnerability in decision-making as well.
If you're going to put a message out to all Australians who may listen to this, what would you want to say about the role of mining?
I would encourage people to just use somebody like myself as an example. I grew up on the west coast of South Africa. I thought farming was my destiny. I had a family that came out of farming in Zimbabwe that ended up in mining because we lost the land after the war, the independence. And by fortunate enough, being able to get a good education, I found myself in an industry that has just opened up a smorgasbord of opportunities. And everywhere I go, it's a hole in the ground. It's the people around that hole that is what creates the magic, the fantastic opportunities. I have seen so much of this world, so many cultures, so many opportunities through this industry that I think if I went farming, my world probably would have still been the west coast of South Africa. Probably a lovely world, but nothing as dynamic, as exciting, and as enabling as what this career has offered me to date. And I'm excited about what it still has ahead of me.
And if you're going to give advice to that young bloke on the farm all those years ago, what would you say to young Douglas now?
Honestly, two things. First is, for me, enjoy the ride more. I'm very goal-orientated. I'm finding the moment is where the magic is. Doing the hard yakka to get the goal is where you reflect the stories you tell. When you're having a beer with someone, you're saying, remember when? We don't talk about the outcome. We talk about when it was really hard, or, geez, we found that moment of magic. So if I slowed down and I just enjoyed that more would be the advice I'd give myself. The advice I'm giving my two sons, who are at that stage of finding life partners and growing a life with another person, is plan with them. Because my wife and I chose my career, she put me through university the second time, and then we decided that my career would take us forward as a family. We almost had this unwritten rule that wherever my career moved me, we would move as a family. And Joanne is an unsung hero in this. She stuck to it. She worked her tail off to make sure that the family dynamic worked while I was off challenging the next giant. We've now, as we've got mature, realized that if I wrote a plan with Joe on our family as intently as I have for businesses, we probably would have gone on that ride much more successfully and much happier together. So my advice for myself, but I've lived the life I have, and fortunately I've got the great partner I have who's carried us through those times when I didn't give it focus, I would say to the young folk is, if you pick a life partner, invest as much time planning with them and their needs and how you get there together versus chasing it just ahead and ensuring that you challenge every giant that comes along. Sometimes the giants aren't worth it. What's at home is what's worth it.
On that, Douglas, it's been terrific having you today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to No Limitations.